This is Decentralized, the Decentralized Trials and Research Podcast. We gather here with friends and guests to talk about the latest ways to make research and clinical trials around the world more inclusive, more accessible, more resilient, and more sustainable, all by using decentralized methods. This podcast is recorded live on Clubhouse every Friday, 12 to 1 Eastern, on the TGIF DCT show at the Decentralized Trials Club. You can join the live sessions and add your voice every Friday at noon Eastern time with the free Clubhouse app by following the Decentralized Trials Club. And of course, subscribe to this podcast on your favorite platform to get notified of new episodes. Following the club and subscribing will also help you stay current for any of the bonus content we may drop. And now, it's time to decentralize.
All right. Well, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and welcome to TGIF DTRA. This is Jane Miles, and I'm co-hosting today with Dr. Amir Kalali. Both of us are in California today, and we're super excited to be joined by guests from Switzerland. So a special thank you to both of you for being here late in your day, maybe with the libation of your choice. I'm just going to talk about TGIF for a moment. So I want you to remember that we do this almost every other week or so. It's usually at the same time. We will shift if that helps our guests. You might be with us live or you might be listening on your favorite podcast platform, because we do push these episodes to Spotify, Apple, Google. This one will drop early next week, thanks to the awesome work of Paige. And I want to reinforce that really these topics that we bring up reflect what you want to hear about. So if you have seen a paper, or you've just written a paper, or you saw something that makes you curious, reach out, let us know, and I'll go do the digging to figure out who could come and help us unpack the topic of interest. So today, I'm really thrilled to have Sinja and Mark with us, both of them from the University of Lausanne. And the way they got here is that I was reading papers sometime in July and saw theirs and said, wow, that's the first time I've ever seen a paper that examines how DHTs and DCTs fit together. So I got curious right away, and we're thrilled that you can be with us today. So the way that we'll work the conversation today, as usual, is we'll spend about a half an hour asking questions to Dr. Kohler and Dr. Blanchard, and then we'll open the floor to you. So Amir, any comments here before we dive?
Sure. Just to mention, Craig's not with us today. He's enjoying Korea at the moment this week. So talking actually to some academics in Seoul around decentralized trials. So that's great. And just very excited. Jay and I are both fans of Switzerland. So we're happy to have some Swiss folks with us today.
Well, and I'll be a fan of Korea.
Yeah. Korea's lovely too. They're for sure. Love Korea too. But I think Switzerland beats out most countries, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I would agree. It's a long story, but I knew that I was starting to really love Switzerland when I was watching the Super Bowl in Switzerland, in Swiss German, and still understood everything that was happening.
Okay, that's great.
Right.
What I like most about it, honestly, is the efficiency. I'm an efficiency guy, and I will tell you that just as we start, that I was there recently, and I was asking my concierge how, you know, what time the boats were going to a certain place, and he told me it was 27 minutes past the hour and 47 minutes past the hour. It wasn't 45. It wasn't 40. I feel they were kind of trolling, like the Germans and others whose trains are not running on time at the moment. So I think, you know, Swiss efficiency is certainly something to be proud of. Yeah.
I have been caught by the Swiss efficiency when I wasn't as efficient. So it was a good early lesson. So let's dive in. And first, let's let the doctors introduce themselves. Signia, will you start and then we'll go to Dr. Blanchard?
Yes, sure. So actually, I'm in my third year of my PhD, so I don't even have my doctor yet,
It
but
can be an upgradation.
finishing, yeah, in life science. And I work at the University Hospital in Lausanne and, well, in the rheumatology department together with Marc and Professor Ruglet, who unfortunately couldn't make it today.
Great. And Dr. Blanchard.
Yeah, so I did my PhD in development here in Lausanne with obviously Signia and Professor Huglet, developing digital health solutions for chronic pain conditions. And actually, I have the, I mean, I see that one of my experts, Johannes, is attending. So thank you, Johannes, for joining. It's really nice. So he was the expert of my thesis I got last year. And during our work, we were focusing on the HTs for chronic rheumatology conditions. And I'm still now leading the team in Lausanne, developing solutions for rheumatoid arthritis monitoring.
And is that what Detectra is all about?
Exactly.
Okay, because I was trolling you on LinkedIn, and I think you have a PhD specifically in digital health. Is that correct?
Yeah, kind of, yeah. So it's a life science PhD, but the project was development of digital health technologies. So yeah, it's digital health development oriented training based.
Super, super cool.
Let me ask you a question about that. Obviously, especially in the US, but Europe too, there's been many digital health startups. How does the academic groups in Europe, how do they fit in to the whole ecosystem of developing digital health solutions versus startups?
Oh, that's a good question. It's depending on the ecosystem. Here we have the opportunity to develop startups out of the university hospital. So it's a spin-off tracks that we have where we can get support, non-dilutive support from innovation promoters from the states. And it's a kind of a gray zone between academia and startups. And it's pretty efficient the way it works in the I mean, in Lausanne and in Switzerland, so it's a pretty common way of innovation, of innovating in the medical field. So this is the way we're doing it now here. But yeah, you see digital health initiatives coming out of every type of ecosystems nowadays, and it's a very an emerging field.
Yeah,
So
so
yeah, that's all.
I come across the I know some of the Swiss folks that promote from governmental agencies that promote innovation, etc. Would you say that in Switzerland versus the rest of Europe, is that do you think it's similar? Do you think you're particularly different in Switzerland in terms of kind of funding for academics to be able to innovate? How do you see that in Switzerland versus Europe?
I think innovation is really good in Switzerland. Innovation is really, really good. Probably we are really well compared to the other European countries. And where we face more issues is a bit what happens a bit after innovation, right? When we want to deploy and scale a solution that has been validated. But I think the innovation index in Switzerland is one of the best ones in the world. So this is really a great place to innovate, especially in the medical field. But then, yeah, I think we need more traction for moving forward once the innovation is there.
All right, thank you. All right.
So, do you use a tech transfer model typically? Yeah, okay. Huh. Fun fact, I did not know this. In the United States, tech transfer processes were first developed at the University of Wisconsin. Who knew?
Ooh.
I have a badger. That's why I'm doing the advert here. All
No,
right.
Jane, you have to, because you're being American despite being Canadian. Our friends may not know where a badger is.
That's the mascot of the students at the University of Wisconsin. They're badgers, which are very resilient and dogged in all things they try. So, who knew? All right, Senia, I'm really curious to hear from you. Why did you undertake this research? And why are you interested in this from a rheumatologic point of view?
Well, so at the very beginning of my PhD, obviously, we're working a lot in digital health at the rheumatology service in Lausanne. And then I was starting to research about DTx and DCT because this was kind of the topic of my PhD, or is still the topic of my PhD. And then we thought about maybe there could be a solution to make it easier to validate DTx. So basically, maybe there would be a solution to develop an application that is at the same time a DTx, but could also be used as kind of like a decentralized clinical trial tools to like integrate maybe everything in one to make it easier and then maybe reuse it. So I was starting to dig into that, and then I just realized that actually there is a lot of literature on DCTs and a lot of literature on like DTx and health technology, but there is not really much outside that looks at that in a combined way, and neither from the regulatory perspectives. As Mark said, like we have a lot of innovation, but then transferring it really into the real world is difficult. And I think there is also a lack of basically regular, or like there is a lot of regulatory aspects to consider, and when there is not enough guidance on that, it's also really difficult. So that's how kind of I thought, okay, maybe let's first gather all the evidence together and do a scoping review.
So you were thinking at the very front end, maybe this is a way to, I'll use my own words, create a platform-based solution that would integrate both DCT and DTX. Okay, I'm going to just pin Adam, not for now, but later, because we might have worked on something like that too, in another life. So how did you go about this product? I mean, I've read the paper, but talk us through what you did and maybe what one or two of your surprises were just in the process of uncovering what research already exists.
So while we developed a search strategy that we applied to different databases, and first I thought, well, since we're working in rheumatology, maybe I'm only looking at the field of rheumatology. But however, then I realized like this won't really be like a lot of literature. So I was like, okay, then let's gather evidence from all the areas, and actually, maybe you can benefit from other inputs, not only the field of rheumatology. So, since also rheumatology is connected to other fields, so then we conducted with the search strategy, we looked all the four databases, and then, well, we did an abstract screening to rounds with Mark together, and then afterwards we did full text screening. And that's how we ended up with our 41 articles that we screened. Surprising. Well, maybe this is already a bit far towards the end of the paper, but the claimed benefit of DCTs, basically, and DTX also, that engagement is so easy and everyone will use it. It's for the benefit of the patient. And then the opposite was basically the result of my or our analysis.
So was this a surprise to you?
Yeah,
Really?
definitely was. Yeah. I think
Interesting.
because, well, now that I'm a bit like longer working on it, and for example, we were testing like some applications in fibromyalgia patients, I saw that adherence and engagement is catastrophic. So then at some point, it wasn't so much a surprise anymore. But in the beginning, it was because I've just started. I more or less had no practical experience. I just read the literature, and everyone was claiming that it's so much easier for the patient, and everything is so, like, this is the biggest benefit. So I was, in the beginning, I was convinced a bit that this will be the outcome also. And then it was the opposite.
Interesting, because when I read your paper, I wasn't surprised at all. Right. So there's even a famous TED talk on this. So it's not just digital. Adherence with anything is terrible, from Weight Watchers to medication adherence, right? It just drops off a cliff the longer it goes. So this is basic human behavior, right? It's very common for everything. It's interesting to discuss it, as we will move further, in the context of digital health and something that's delivered that way. But so all I'll tell you is, for me, I wasn't shocked in the slightest that digital has poor adherence, like everything else so far that touches humans and it requires them to comply with a certain routine, right?
But let's talk a little bit about when you were doing your search too, because you're in your third year of your PhD. So when did you turn on the search engine? And I also would like to ask you how many papers were at the top end of the funnel?
Well, at the very first time, I think that was in 23.
Okay, I have some comments there, but and it was more than 1,000 papers at the top, just probably based on keywords, is that right?
Well, with the exact search strategy, then it was like 335 or something like that. But then, but yeah, if you look a bit more general, you would come up with like 1,000 or something.
And here's where I was going with the date stamp here, because Dr. Kalali and Craig and I talk a lot about how the hype cycle of DCTs overinflated everything from the claims of what was DCT to who was a DCT expert to exactly what benefits DCT would bring you. Now, I'm still a huge advocate for it. I'm just saying we believe we got a double hit of hype cycle with the COVID effect and the market interest in the new modality. And Amir, you might have something to say there too.
I thought you were going to go after the fact that maybe her search thing would have been a little different pre-ChatGPT and post-ChatGPT. But no, I think what's interesting actually is quite impressive though that many papers in the DHT and DCT, quite honestly. And I've looked at the number of papers you looked at, obviously, and saw kind of I'm familiar with many of them. But yeah, no, it's I mean it seems like an obvious thing to deliver DHT strip, right? So that seems like a definitely a good area for us to go. But I don't want to interrupt your flow of just talking the audience through kind of what the what the process of getting there, what they found. So I'll just let you continue that sort of flow of conversation, please.
Well, maybe as you went through the papers, first of all, you had hoped that you would be able to focus in a lot on rheumatology, but in case people haven't read the papers, what were the more common therapeutic areas or even applications and use cases for the DHTs?
Well, the most frequent one was mental health, and then in there they were focusing a lot on depression. There was also substance abuse. There were some cardiovascular applications. We also had a few pelvic floor applications. It was
So, as
quite
you uncovered,
diverse.
were you thinking that there would be relatable, transferable lessons from those different therapeutic areas into your rheumatologic space, or were you concerned, what they saw isn't going to reflect what we will see?
No, I think maybe, okay, if you consider, of course, like endpoints and so on, it's probably different. But still, I think there are learnings from when we talk about engagement, as Dr. Kalali said, this is an issue in all the areas. It doesn't matter what trial. So I think still you can learn a lot. And there were some details from like studies that were reported from not really rheumatology, like not at all, and that we are actually already implementing now or using as a lesson while we're working on our other projects in rheumatology.
Can you give some examples of those?
Yeah, for example, there were some papers that talked a lot about onboarding the patient, for example. So before you let them go back home and use an application in a trial or even in the real world, you basically should introduce them to the technology. And we've seen that actually patients, even though we think we're living in a digitalized world and everything, they still struggle. And it's not just old people. You cannot even say that it's just the older ones, but really, so for example, help them download the application. Do a test with them together in the first time, assist them, All of these are like barriers, and it doesn't really matter if this is an application or a technology for rheumatology, or is this, or whether this is for oncology. So this is transferable knowledge.
So we kind of started with the headline that one of the major findings was kind of the retention rates so poor. Can you talk about some of the upsides that you found and why DCTs were seen to be actually helpful?
Well, DCTs was, I mean, has the benefit or showed that there was a benefit that, like, there were studies that did a trial in a nursing home that probably most likely without a DCT wouldn't happen. So they could test that in a population basically that would most likely be otherwise excluded from a clinical trial, because who will bring a patient to a trial center that lives in a nursing home? Like, if there are no relatives that will do that, it will be very hard. So this is definitely a benefit, or like recruiting faster. And I think Jane mentioned it. We never want to spend again like 7 years of recruiting patients. So like screening a lot of patients faster, advertising via social media, I think these things are benefiting and were mentioned in articles that was a benefit.
So, dramatically improve access, more representative samples, etc., right?
Maybe if you can keep them.
Yeah, but I mean, in general,
Exactly.
yeah, sure. So, I guess my question, I mean, clearly, these studies show that you improve access and representation, diversity, maybe, right? But you had the cost was there was a big drop off. I noticed, I'm trying to remember. That well, only 40% of the participants installed the app in some studies. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly.
But my question would be, so okay, so you know that. So then, when you're running your study, is the answer that because you're using a DCT, you have a much wider net and you have far more people coming in? But then I would assume if you don't install the app, you shouldn't even be in the study. Like that's kind of a screen. So you may have a high screen fail rate, but that doesn't mean you can't run a successful study if your funnel is big enough by using a DCT study, right? It just seems to me you're just reaching out to more people, a lot will drop off, but you'll end up with a number of people that's still way higher than if you weren't using a DCT. Am I missing something or does that make sense?
No, I think that makes sense. And also, well, the thing is, you maybe say, okay, they don't install the app, but then you keep maybe the decentralized way and say, okay, we still don't want them to come to the clinic so that we can install the app for them. But maybe you introduce like a little help of like doing a short Zoom. So you can still keep it decentralized, but you kind of find the barrier or that is hindering them, and you foster that they download the app, for example.
So you mentioned that it's not just about age. What do you think we should, or maybe you're not there yet. Like, do you have a rubric or a way to describe what is digital literacy that would actually be required as a quote inclusion criteria?
Well, maybe I wouldn't use it as an inclusion criteria, because, for example, if you would say, oh, you should have used health apps before or something like that, then you probably limit already or exclude a lot of people. So you introduce also the barrier or something that is not quite fair for everyone. But I think maybe if people don't have first experiences with using technology in the health field, they maybe should get a training first to get familiar with it. Yeah, so I think it's that they have to be familiar with technology, but also being familiar specifically in the health area how they can use technology. So like, is it telemonitoring? Is it an application that helps to report your symptoms? So I think a bit of knowledge in both of the areas required.
Ooh, let's talk about symptom reporting, because way back in the day, let's say 15 years ago, Lucinia, you were probably in middle school. We were so worried that by giving people access to these health apps, we would suddenly get a massive influx of safety event reports, either from the data itself or even from patients creating comments and reporting things. So, what did your research show about that?
Actually, a few papers mentioned the safety aspect and discussed it a little bit, but it was more general, like, yeah, adverse events were collected. But actually, it was quite or I'm not even sure if it's surprising, but there were very little events actually reported. So that I think that was a positive aspect.
I'm going there because I've been reflecting a little bit about why it's hard to innovate, especially in pharma. And this is not in your paper, but maybe it's a reflection that we could explore elsewhere. I wonder if it's just easy to say no because it's easy to say this is a risk and I'm not willing to take it. If you're in pharma, like, oh, all those new safety issues could undermine the development of whatever it is I'm trying to do. So that's a big no. What do you think about that?
Jane, let me just briefly comment on that because I think neither our guests are in pharma. I don't think this is a pharma issue. I think this is a scientist issue. So
Yeah.
scientists, we're all trained to come up with all the reasons why we're clever because we can find all the reasons something won't work, right? We're kind of the opposite of improv, which is yes and. We're always, if you go to a bunch of scientists with any idea, they think, they've been clever by shooting down as much as they can. I mean, that's how we're trained. This is how you go, but it won't work for the, and there's that. I will tell you, there's also a European bias. I always laugh doing a lot of global work. The US mindset is a little bit different. The US mindset kind of does it and worries about the consequences later. I think Europeans are much more about thinking about the consequences and maybe not pulling the trigger. So I think there's a scientific, that's my answer, but I'd like to think what our Swiss friends think. I see Mark nodding, so what do you think, Mark?
Well, I think it really, I mean, coming about talking about the feedbacks from the app, either you're going to get, or for the symptom reporting, either you're going to get like too much flags, like red flags, or you're going to get the underreported patients. That's also something we identified in an earlier study that I did during my PhD where we had the patients. Basically, we would have the patients that would overreport all the time and potentially use that device to have more connection with the clinicians, more connection with the care. And we had the patients that would underreport because they didn't want to disturb. So I don't know if that also is in addition to what you were saying, but I think it's really dependent on the patients, on the conditions, on the psychological status, or I don't know, education. And this has to be taken into account. And as a scientist, it's like, patients are all different. Even though they might have the same disease, this has to be taken into account when we give them a scale from 1 to 10 about the pain, right? Some patients might say 10 with a very low pain, and others just, suffer a lot and would say 2.
Is the same in a traditional trial setting and in a DCT, right? So this is the other thing I was just going to mention. Like we sometimes I feel like we make the bar higher for the thing that is new, even though that problem exists in the trial model already. Yeah, sorry, I'm here.
I mean, I think your biggest finding was kind of looking at retention rates, right? Adherence. That is obviously a big problem because that's where you're talking effectiveness versus efficacy, right? So all these digital solutions who may seem they're really a great way to treat certain things, if patients aren't adhering, your effectiveness in the real world is obviously much lower. So that's a real problem. Certainly in the US, it will may lead to kind of difficulty getting reimbursed if you're not showing that kind of effectiveness in the real world, right? So, but you mentioned kind of part of what you've tried to do, learning lessons, was kind of the more intense onboarding, or at least onboarding, right? So if you think that through, So what is the best experience you could possibly have? It would be like a high-end concierge service for every patient, where they would have a concierge that holds their hand, does everything for them throughout the trial, not just to download the app, right? Well, there's two problems with that. There is the scaling. How do you have the resources to do that? But you could argue maybe new AI coaches could actually do all that. So you will have a chat bot that will help you download the app, talk to you every day, do all of that. So now it's possible to do that. But something that sounds good, right? Then you'll find a lot of scientists saying, especially in neuroscience, which is where you found where it was being done the most, right? You will find people worry about placebo response. So a lot of people are going to say, well, wait, if I do this white glove, high touch thing, am I going to drive up placebo? This is a very common problem neuroscience people worry about, right? And I'm not sure what the answer is, but is that something you guys think about in rheumatology in your case? Do you have any thoughts around that? If we made it more white glove, will that make it problematic from a placebo point of view?
Well, maybe just one from the first thing you said is basically, yes, you want to support the patients maybe a bit more so that they maybe have the chance to still catch up with the technology or digital health literacy. But then I think it's also, as you said, like you cannot do too much because then maybe you're investing a lot during the trial. They maybe adhere during the trial because you're making such a big effort to keep them. But then you go to the real world, you give them the application, and then suddenly there is no more support, or not to this extent, and
Yes.
then adherence goes zero. So I think you have to find a balance, and maybe we also have to accept what Mark said. Basically, we have different patients. Not everyone will be suitable to a DCT, and not everyone will be suitable to use a DTX at home. So maybe we need to find a sweet spot also that. Maybe we can reach more patients than usual. So we get a chance that we still kind of have better sample, but then we still have to accept that maybe retention is will not be necessarily a lot better than usual.
I like your AI assist concept here, Dr. Kalali. But I'm going to just reset the room and say we're at the bottom of the hour. We are not done yet. But now, if you have questions, it's a great time to raise your hand or drop them in the chat. And Jean has actually dropped a question in the chat, but she's also willing to ask it directly, which I think is perfect. So, Jean.
Thanks, everyone. This is an absolutely fascinating conversation, and I'm grateful that I had the time to join. And I did also read your paper in advance. And as I'm listening to the dialogue, really always an interesting dialogue when it comes to Jane and Amir. I'm thinking from, all the experience that I bring as a first as a hair healthcare provider, and now working in pharma and being really astounded at the delays and the constant non-acceptance, right, of doing something really impactful for patients based on the digital technologies that we have available to us and all the things, all the excuses that we face every day about why we don't. And then I just think about it from the more recent engagement that I've had with people like yourselves that are really doing the research to figure out what are those barriers. And the two things that stuck with me certainly was adherence on so many levels. And I almost feel that the adherence can improve with the kinds of situations we talked about. And if I put that in the context of a future where we're looking at truly embedding where patients access clinical trials, wherever they get their care, even if it's in their home or some remote places, all of the tools that would allow that flexibility, right, that fit for purpose for the individual patient are all coming together, right? I think the human and the AI element offer some really good opportunities for addressing those concepts around adherence, whether it's during the actual trial itself or after. If we start, what is that embedding of research and care and those HCPs that may not be PIs? Is the next step in improving those obstacles, including adherence, really that education? I heard one of you talk about, is it just education or is it really embracing the fact that it's never going to be a one size fits all? that by nature, we're going to have to build in some level of fit for purpose flexibility. And then as I've listened to some of the more patient advocacy groups really, dig in on this, who owns the responsibility of that concept of techquity, right? Techquity is that equity and access to the technologies that might bring in more diverse representative communities and patients. How do we address all these things? And in your literature review and in your research, and as you think about the ending of your PhD, are you seeing some opportunities that we could all be thinking about that could help us kind of overcome these particular obstacles? So lots of things. And I do agree that not only the individual patient, but the therapeutic area and the population, and even where that population may live, will drive all of the potential things we're looking to accomplish. I have complete confidence we'll be able to figure it out eventually, but just curious if you're thinking about it in any of those contexts.
Yeah, I think we're in a good time actually, because, well, you have the chance basically to use the technology maybe, so you can start using it, but you also don't have to. So I think there is a sweet spot that it's not like forced on patients. So I think those who want, they can catch up. Or I think more and more healthcare professionals try to also from their side catch up and introduce it to their patients. So I think this is a good opportunity right now to kind of get on the train, or like still there is the other side that those who absolutely don't want to, they don't have to. Like there is still the opportunity that they can come, for example, to the clinic instead of like talking via the screen. And I think this was also mentioned in the paper, like some papers found that it was like for fostering that people didn't feel so lonely with like a chatbot or an AI tool. However, others felt like, oh, I'm being isolated, I'm being disconnected from my healthcare professional, from my healthcare provider. So I think, as you said, maybe not everything fits for everyone, but I think we're in a good time that you can kind of adapt it to your patients.
Yeah, I think it is an opportunity, right? We're all trying to catch up and learn what is the best use of the evolution of AI in particular. And also that concept of the flexibility and building trust with patients will help us go a long way, right? With getting more patients to enroll in trials and commit to the things we ask them to, but we have to respect that individuality in the process. Really good stuff. Thanks for sharing.
Sharon, we have a comment. Thanks for the question. Do you want to read that?
Well, Archana, if you can come on off mute, please ask your question.
Hi, this is Archana, and thank you for sharing your great research today. I had a question, if you had, and sorry, I apologize, I have not read your paper yet, but I was curious if you had looked at the impact of quality of the technology when you were evaluating different DHTs, in terms of the ease of use by the patients and its impact on the adherence by the patients. Technologies can differ in terms of the interface and how they interact the way it has been designed. So I was curious about that aspect of your research.
Yeah, so we actually, one key aspect that was mentioned in most of the papers was actually a patient-centered design for the clinical trial, but also for the application. But still, although that was considered in most papers, so patients were involved in designing and the applications, the technologies, and the trial design, still we faced a lot of issues with the adherence. But maybe actually I let Mark comment on that, because that's his field of expertise, actually.
Yeah, so yeah, we've seen in Lausanne, we've seen how it affects definitely in terms of the quality of tech. For example, we had started a trial with a device that was on a web-based application. So it was running on a web browser, basically. And we had it was a catastrophe in terms of getting the patients in. We switched to a mobile app after quite an effort on the tech side, because in the hospital, it's not easy to code apps. And the improvement was significant. But I don't think these were always present in your work, Sinia, in the review that you did. It was not always mention, right? And there was no real emphasis on the importance of
I
that
mean
aspect.
They mentioned like but they designed the trial, the application and so on, but they didn't really afterwards talk so much about like user experience. The only thing I remember was like that they said, okay, for example, patients reported unstable Bluetooth connection when they were like trying to pair a device or something, or that there was not enough storage for their data, and then, well, if you don't have enough storage anymore, you will stop using it. So these were a few issues, but I don't think they were so much related to user experience, or it was not reported.
Okay, so let's actually take that in, Archana. Unless you have a follow-up question, I'm going to pull Sinha and Mark over to the framework they're proposing, because I really love that part of your paper. So why don't you walk us through, after doing all this analysis, you created a framework, it's in the paper, but what are some key elements that you really want the audience to hear about in this framework, and maybe a big takeaway for people to be thinking about as they're moving ahead?
I think what is, or for me, what I think would be important also, because you mentioned there are barriers from to accept DCTs, also in pharma. I think we should standardize kind of our approaches and mention certain things, follow certain procedures so that we can like show better the evidence, that we can compare better. So I think, yeah, that would be one of the key takeaways why I think a framework is important. And I think it's not complete. I think it will develop, and it would definitely be also, I would wish that it will develop also with more research that is coming, maybe from other authors, researchers. But maybe for me, important would be, well, we've seen more or less everywhere already e-recruitment. So this is what we touched upon, like we can recruit more patients. The possibility of eligibility screening that can be faster and easier, rather than having someone who is like checking a checklist at the clinic, you can distribute that. There are tools that were mentioned in some studies that are really good, like you can hinder patients from going back and changing their answers. So there is a lot out there already that we kind of know it. I think it's just important that we gather that and that we start using these so that it doesn't get lost kind of when we have these experiences. Well, electronic informed consent, this is unfortunately, it seems so simple, but in Switzerland, we are so, so slow with that. So this is really this is an issue, I think, that we're not fast enough for this.
Why do you think you're slow in Switzerland? Like, I'm just curious.
Well, I think it could be because we're we have all the different cantons, and everyone has a bit their own rules, so everyone is kind of doing it their own way. So it's hard to, if you have different solutions, then to kind of implement one solution and it gets to everywhere. So I think we actually have now 5 university hospitals that are using electronic informed consent. But I mean, this is very little if you look at all the hospitals we have.
Right.
And then I think also important, there are possibilities to combine. So it doesn't need to be a trial that is only using digital health technologies. You can combine that with still like therapy at the clinic. So I think these nuances are important, that you're not forced to, like, there is a lot of flexibility. And I think it's a nice way to combine these aspects also. And also one aspect that I think would be great is if we can, we have patient-centered design that is really important, and I think it's good in the trial design and also in the design of the application. But then we should take it a step further, and then maybe if we already have these tools, why not also keep them connected to the research and distribute, for example, the findings through the application that they were using, through the technology that they were using, and then maybe you can even inform them, next about upcoming trials, about new research in the field. So that really kind of you try to interconnect these different steps.
Like a life cycle.
Yeah.
If you will. But let's talk a little bit, because this is my passion, the patient engagement domain. Like, my finding is it's one thing to ask people what they want theoretically. It's a different thing if you show them what it's going to look like. And I see Mark shaking, like nodding. So let's hear what you think about that. And how might we get closer to what they would experience that is not so theoretical?
Oh well, I was laughing because this was really what I was focusing on during my PhD, and we were focusing on patients with chronic pain syndromes, so mostly fibromyalgia patients, and investigating their what they would expect from the app, and then checked how they basically used the app with the content that was in. And it was just so diverse. Again, you cannot have a one-size-fits-all solution, but it's really also depending, I guess, on the type of diseases and the type of patients you have. But in this situation, we had patients that, we had patients that thought the app was way too complicated to use, to patients that thought it was way too easy. And if we add a bit more complexity, because some might expect that, so we did surveys, collect that, we improved the complexity, then others would complain. It's again always the same thing. Yeah. The more complex the solution, the more difficult it is to please everyone. That's why now we're focusing on monitoring. It's easy.
By the way, I'm only laughing because I hear exactly the same thing from research sites, right? Like, you always tell us that it's going to be this way, and then we experience it completely differently. And then this week, one of the things that came up was, why can't you just have a sandbox that lets us play with it before we're signed up for the trial? Which is not actually that easy a request to fulfill. I see Amir is nodding, so maybe you have some thoughts there too.
No, I disagree with you. I think we hear that feedback all the time. Yep.
Okay. Any other questions out in the audience? Because I could ask you questions forever.
Well, I want to go back to sort of something we touched on briefly, which was this idea of what happens if you really do a white glove for the patient during the trial and they go to the real world. So my question is, well, to me, the problem is we don't have white glove in the real world. So part of DHT is, to me, it seems you have some minority of digital therapeutics that claim to be actual treatments, right? That will actually change the patient on their own. They're the minority. But I think most digital solutions are not claiming to necessarily be the primary treatment, but somehow to enhance the effectiveness of other treatments, right? And it seems to me that enhancing that support, that engagement throughout the real world experience for a patient, because I consider telling you in the US, even in the best centers, there's just not the bandwidth for the healthcare systems to support the patient in any way which they need truly. So I think I'm hoping with the coaching and AI coaching, at least we'll have a bit more bandwidth, but it just seems to me this is where we should not so much go, well, what happens when we drop the support in the real world? The real world should be really developing that support that's maybe enables that engagement. I mean, maybe there's a reason why people aren't adhering, right? So, but we're not doing enough to help them this year. So that's kind of what I think about, honestly, in terms of the real world.
I like where you're headed there. I don't know if that's a reality I'm going to see come to life, but
it's not a research thing. It's a clinical care thing.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Now, I'm interested to know what you guys are planning in rheumatology, because I'm a neuroscience guy myself. So I know the work in depression, but how are you using digital, hopefully, in rheumatology?
Well, the Tectra is our main project, actually. So it's not the DTX, but it's more for monitoring. And I think this is maybe also where adherence is a bit less of a problem. So it's more about reporting symptoms. It's about getting the chance to have a monitoring possibility where you're actually not so much disconnected from your healthcare professional, because the idea would be that your healthcare professional can follow you more frequently than without the technology. So there is still this aspect, and there is a lot of research also, like when actually the healthcare professional is checking what the patient is doing, they're more likely to adhere, they're more likely to follow. So this is less of actually a treatment that we're looking at in rheumatology in the digital field in our research or at the SHUV. So it's more about monitoring patients, facilitating maybe a more frequent interaction that is not possible without the technology.
So is that mainly just patient-reported outcomes, or are you doing anything else within digital that's not just PRO?
Mark, please go ahead. This is your...
Yeah. So it's very interesting topic. It started during the COVID. We thought it would be great to access, to have access to patients. And it started with an idea that we all have great cameras on our phones, right? And in inflammatory arthritis, we have swelling that happens in the joints. And hands are definitely the ones that are the most affected. But disabilities, everything is, I mean, usually when your hands are not working well, nothing is actually doing well. So mm-hmm. we developed the technology. You can take pictures of your hands, basically, and we assess objectively over time, longitudinally, how the things are moving. And on top of that, the patient-reported outcomes, standards for disease activity tracking in inflammatory arthritis, for example, in rheumatoid arthritis, and we developed an app for that. And all of that developed a patient management system, basically, so we can manage the patients remotely. All the patients that would not need a visit, we can do it via the dashboard. Healthcare providers can do remote visits with that. And all the ones that actually do need a visit, we can quickly figure out that they do need the visits, and optimize the scheduling of the patients, and basically seeing the patients that are really need to be seen, and not see the patients that actually are doing fine and, you know, will do a potentially non-mandatory checkup.
That's awesome.
That's the whole idea. That's the whole idea of the Tektra.
Yes, I live in the United States, but I'm a Canadian. And so the distribution of rheumatologists is very, very, very thin across a very big country.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, are you working with researchers in other countries or clinicians to see how they might implement these monitoring techniques too?
Well, that's very interesting, because as you said, you have geographically the way you have a lot of specialists in cities, way less in rural areas. So depending on the geography, depending on the healthcare system, the way the billing works, these things are very different. We are working with centers in Europe with clinical trials that are upcoming with Austria, Germany, Denmark. And we are also exchanging a lot during international conferences, also with people from Canada, people from the United States. And we understand all the different problems, which always comes back to the access to care. And in the end, whether you're in a city or you're living really far away from your potential doctor, if you are lucky enough to have a doctor, access to care is really what we should be enhancing. And this is why we are working so hard on that project.
Oh, I have a couple of follow-up ideas for you outside of this conversation, but
please reach out by
yeah,
email.
I will,
and we can do another meeting.
Well, in fact, I'm going to the patient conference on myositis next week, and so it's timely, right? Because we have a huge problem with late diagnosis, underdiagnosis, and then a huge problem with access. So I'll park that, Sinja. You're going to finish this year. What are you going to do next?
What I'm going to do next? So, well, I'm actually already kind of working on the Autopix project that Mark mentioned. So we will test actually the Tektra in clinical trials. And I'm most likely going to continue working with the team in Lausanne, trying to make these trials work and try to prove that the Tektra can help detect flares, help to diagnose earlier. Yeah.
That's awesome. If you want to talk about clinical trial simulations and how that might help you, that could be another follow-up conversation. But Dr. Kalali, any last questions from you or comments?
The other thing I will say is I think a great incentive for patients to adhere might be that they get a bit of Swiss chocolate if they adhere every step. Like every visit that you do, you get sent a bit of chocolate. What do you think?
Well, yeah, maybe we could implement that, but I'm not sure if the diabetologist will be happy.
Oh, our Swiss chocolate is pretty healthy, I hear. So my last question is, we have two Swiss people here. What is the best brand of Swiss chocolate?
Oh dear.
Ooh, dangerous. Signia, go ahead.
Lindt.
Oh, it's the first time we agree. It's the first time we agree. I was not expecting to. Amazing. I
Really?
agree.
Have you been to the new museum, the Lindt Museum?
No, I haven't been.
Zurich, really? Oh, okay, I
Well,
have.
it's like the people in Paris, they never visited the Eiffel
Yeah.
Tower, right?
I will say that I have been to the Zurich Lindt Museum. I will tell you, it doesn't have the most number of chocolate. There are other places in Zurich that have more chocolate, like variety than they're very good vintage chocolate sort of wrappers and stuff. It's kind of the history of chocolate. But there's actually different shops in Zurich that have a bigger quality of number of chocolates than the museum, just FYI. Did you have
Thanks.
a comment before we left? No.
No, I was just joining in the laughter, and you are making us all hungry, by
Yeah.
the way.
I'm feeling like I want to go to Switzerland now just for the chocolate. But I want to say thank you so much for joining us. It is late in your day. I hope you get to have the libation of choice. Maybe it's hot chocolate. But I'm really thrilled that you shared your research with us. And most importantly, I'm really thrilled you're doing the research because I think you're on to things that will help patients in all sorts of therapeutic areas.
And Jane, I think maybe at some point we'll go back to Lausanne and there's a nice little La Prairie spa there too you'd enjoy.
Please reach out if you
Yeah,
ever
we'll
come back
continue.
to Switzerland. And thanks so much
We'll
for
be happy to.
the invitation.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Thank you
Bye.
so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank
Bye.
you. Bye-bye.